It's important to stress that. It's also important to realize when we criticize what Ariel Sharon is doing, we have to put it in context. The U.S. response to September 11th, the military response, we didn't go through the U.N., we didn't find suspects, we didn't provide any proof to the Taliban government, which asked for evidence, we attacked. And even General Franks admitted last week when he was when there was a lot of news going on that maybe Bush knew this, maybe Bush knew that, and there was talks about a possible terrorist attack over Memorial Day weekend, General Franks, who is the supreme commander in Afghanistan, was afraid that he was going to be blamed. You failed in your job there, because your job there was to stop terrorism. If there's a terrorist attack, you failed. And so he made a statement. Look, he said, our attack here has downgraded Al-Qaeda, but nobody should be operate under the misconception that our attack on Afghanistan was a primary response to September 11th. It was merely a country that was strategically viable for an attack. In other words, this is a country we could attack. And so we did. And it really satisfied a political need for there to be military action as opposed to a really significant military response. But in any event, we attacked, and we attacked widespread. And in this attack on the Taliban in Kandahar, we used fuel air explosives, the poor man's nuke, very, very destructive firebombs causing firestorms in that area. And when Dick Cheney was asked about this, why we did this, he said it was to terrorize Taliban troops. So this is our opposition to terror. We're terrorizing people. And In context of this, Colin Powell made an objection to the Russian government bombing civilians in Chechnya, and Alexander Putin says, we're only fighting terrorism like you are. And when diplomatic protests were made to the Israelis to withdraw from Jenin and so on, they said, we're in the war on terrorism just like you are. And now that Musharraf might fire nuclear weapons at the Indians, or the Indians, they're going to claim the same thing. We've created a very, very, very bad standard, and we have to backtrack and support international law, join the world court, allow almost everyone in Washington to be prosecuted for war crimes if they, and then they either get off or they don't. And, submit ourselves to standards so we can hold other people to those standards as well. And remember, like this graffiti in Jenin, killing civilian people doesn't bring peace. If we could learn that, we would learn a lot. That killing civilians makes hatred, not, you know, it doesn't end. You know, the logic of Al Capone doesn't work. And an example, a contrary example, this man in the foreground, Jerry Levin, and his wife in the back, Sissy Levin, in the red hats, is a good example. Jerry was the CNN bureau chief in Beirut during the civil war there, very, very violent civil war. He was kidnapped by Hezbollah. He's an American Jew. He was held for a year, prisoner, blindfolded. He was tortured. He lost a hearing in his right ear. He was beaten repeatedly. His wife kept going through the State Department for his release. They couldn't do a thing. Finally, she got sick and tired of waiting, and she went to Syria. She learned Arabic. She donned Arab dress. She went into the Bekaa Valley. She found her husband, and she rescued him. Look up her name. I'm sorry I don't have the title of the book, but it's an incredible book about the rescue of her husband. This woman has chutzpah. And when you would think in the aftermath of this, though, that Jerry Levin, after being so badly treated by Muslim nationalists, would be an anti-Muslim person, a hateful and vengeful person. But he isn't. He thought about what happened to him. He studied the history of the region, and he came to the conclusion that Israeli and U.S. policy in that area was so bad, so rotten, so oppressive, that he didn't support terrorism, but he understood the frustration and anger that people felt, and felt if people are going to do something nonviolent, they need to be encouraged and supported. And so instead of being vengeful, he and his wife joined Christian peacemaker teams, and they now go to places like Hebron, where they act as human shields to protect Muslims from the attacks by Jewish settlers and Israeli soldiers. And their bravery and courage and forgiveness is so renowned that there isn't a Muslim home anywhere in the West Bank and Gaza Strip where these people can't walk safely and aren't welcomed as heroes. So in a way, by responding differently to September 11th, we wouldn't have to continually be afraid every time we take a plane or get in a bus or go to a sporting event that, gee, is this going to be the one where they're going to blow us up? Pope Paul VI said, if you want peace, work for justice. And these people have brought peace in their relationships, improved the prestige of individual Jews and Judaism in general by their behavior. And so, because of that, because of all of these peace activists, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, and secular, I believe that, like this Palestinian 11-year-old who's operating a front-end loader with his nice sunglasses to remove a barrier under the protection of international activists, to remove a barricade, and that all the barricades, all the barriers to peace can be removed. And I think we can get together to say, end this occupation, live in peace, and make a region that's safe for all of these traditions and other traditions, too, to live there, irrespective of their beliefs. And that this Palestinian Muslim girl from the Gaza Strip and this Israeli Jewish boy at the Wailing Wall can enjoy the same kind of peace and security that these children enjoy at the public magnet school where my children go in Worcester. This is a kindergarten where rich and poor kids from all of the city come, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, all kinds of different kids. And you go and you talk to the kids in the kindergarten and you realize that hatred is not something we're born with. Racism, bigotry, nationalism, these are taught. We start with an innocence. And also you realize, even in the older kids, that even though we develop certain prejudices here in the United States and we have a long way to go, Muslims, Christians, and Protestants, Catholics are not killing each other in the streets. We have a level of tolerance here that we've come to expect, and by statute, an even higher level of tolerance. And really, we should apply those standards as a necessary prerequisite for aid to other countries. We shouldn't be supporting the bad guys around the world. We should be, and whether it's Yasser Arafat or Ariel Sharon, if they're not living up to human rights standards, they should not get our aid. And instead, people like Ghassan Ondani and Rabbi Arik Asherman, they should be the names we know. And they should be the people we support. Just like we supported Bishop Desmond Tutu in South Africa. We should support those moderate forces, and then we can see change. Now, I just have one little postscript here, and I know I've gone a long time, and I beg your forgiveness for it. My mother said I was vaccinated with a phonograph needle. Anyway, this is my wife, Claire, and this is at a woman's demonstration during the war in Kosovo, and I just want to tell one anecdote that underscores this for me personally. We met at the Catholic Worker in Washington, D.C., and at that point, there were two houses of hospitality, a men's and a woman's house, near each other. And she was working one night in the woman's house, and we had 18 women guests. She was the only volunteer at that time. And she's a graduate of the University of Virginia, very wealthy family. She was sleeping on the couch because we had so many guests there were no beds. And one of our guests, a woman named Pat Robinson, a very articulate black woman who had graduated from Harvard and found herself on the street temporarily, was staying with us, came down and went in the kitchen around midnight, the little pantry, turned on the light and started taking out pots and pans to cook. One of the other guests who was sleeping on a cot nearby came over to Claire and said, "Please make her stop. It's so late. She keeps doing this." And so Claire went over and said, "Pat, we've told you 100 times before, don't cook at midnight." Pat spun around and said, "You know, I'm sick and tired of this. Where do you get off, you 22-year-old sanctimonious white bonk, 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 coming down here and lecturing to us? You're going to do your 1 year a little do-good in the ghetto and then go and write a book about poverty or maybe lecture and make big money." And she just went in a rant. In a rant at Claire, and said, "You don't know the first thing about what it's like to grow up black and female and so on." And one of the women came over to say something, and Pat took a pan in her hand to hit the woman, and Claire stood between and got hit. And we have a policy of not calling the police to resolve conflicts in our houses, but our guests don't always agree with that policy. So one of the guests went over to call on a payphone to call the police, and because we had a payphone in the house. And Pat saw it, pushed Claire out of the way, went over, pushed the woman out of the way, and grabbed the payphone and pulled it off the wall. Now, I want you to grab a payphone sometime and try to make it move. And this woman had adrenaline going through her, you know, really racing through. And then she proceeded to scream and yell and throw punches periodically and get angry. And Claire, all the while, tried to protect other people. At 6 in the morning, I went over to see if Claire wanted to go to morning mass. I knock on the door. The door swings open. Pat goes by. I go in. There's broken furniture, broken lamps, glass. Claire's all black and blue. Unbelievable. And we're sitting and talking about it and trying to decide what we can do. And it occurred to me that we'd been given an offer to take a retreat at a Trappist abbey in Virginia, the Holy Cross Abbey. I said, "Maybe this is a good time for us to go pray about what we should do." And Claire said, "Okay." So we went that night to Holy Cross Abbey. And Pat Robinson came back carrying a big long knife, which the guest described as a sword, kicked the front door and said, "Where is that white bitch?" to kill Claire. And by the way, this is a side note. You ever get the urge to take a retreat, you should always take it. Because that may be a good intuition. Anyway, we came back and we got a call from St. Elizabeth's Hospital, a mental hospital, that said they had Pat there. And that she had a history of periodic violent psychotic outbursts. when she wasn't taking meds and stuff and everything. And so we said, oh, okay. So we felt better. She was at the hospital, and we let it go. Well, 3 days later, the hospital called us again and said, we released Pat yesterday on a day pass, and she didn't come back. And we don't know where she is. Oh, good. So now for a while, we're like, what are we going to do? And we tried to think of a nonviolent answer. And for a while, we had a few extra volunteers around. But we have a lot of commotion in these houses, and eventually we forgot about her. And 8 months later, Claire and I were married in Washington, and we moved to Worcester. A year after that, we're walking down Main Street. At this point, we're 8 months pregnant, 8.5 months pregnant with our first child. And who do we see coming up the street? And I'm like, some kind of Twilight Zone. I said, maybe she won't recognize us. And she comes up the street. She goes, Claire, Scott, how are you? I said, good. She goes, where do you live? I said, oh, around. And she talks to us very cheerfully and walks away. And I said, oh, boy, I says, what a piece of bad karma. And Claire starts having nightmares about Pat punching her in the abdomen and the baby dying. You know, first pregnancy, bad anyway, very stressful. And about 5 days after that, she's at the library near closing by herself, and she walks in the stacks of the public library. Who's at the other end of the aisle but Pat? And Claire's like, oh, my God, run away, run away. And then she's thinking, love the enemy, forgive, oh, yada, yada, all this stuff. So she walks up to her very nervously and starts talking to her. In the course of the conversation, it gets more and more genuine and comfortable. And finally, Claire says, you know, Pat, I want to talk to you about that night that you hit me. She says, you know, it was wrong to do that. We were giving you hospitality and everything. It was wrong. But there was a lot of truth in what you said. I realize now, years later, that no matter how much work I do for the poor, I'll always be a person of privilege. And you were absolutely right. And, you know, and anyway, they ended up having a really good conversation about racism, at the end of which Pat says, how's the pregnancy going? Claire says, good. I'm doing a lot of walking. They say it helps with the labor. And Pat says, any physical problems? And Claire said, I noticed some swelling in my ankles tonight. Pat says, call your doctor right away. It could be a condition called preeclampsia, which, if untreated, can become toxemia and can be very serious. And the only external symptom is swelling in the ankles and high blood pressure, which you can't feel. Claire says, well, thanks for the advice. She comes home, tells me, think I should call the doctor? I said, Claire, you had a prenatal 4 days ago. And you know, no, all due, you know, due respect, Pat is a little, you know. And so Claire says, well, I feel better if I call. So she calls the hospital. The hospital doesn't want to see us, but we went anyway. We went to see the doctor. The doctor examined her. Claire's blood pressure was through the roof. So they admitted her to the hospital, had her lay on her side for 3 days to try to lower the pressure. It didn't work. They gave her Pitocin-induced labor, and my son was born in the intensive care unit. And the doctor told us afterwards, there's no doubt about it. She, my wife, and my son would have died if she had not had the conversation with Pat. And we have 4 children now, and these are the 2 youngest. And they're wonderful kids. I can't say enough about them. And, you know, for me, you know, the love your enemies and this nonviolent stuff, this is not about being soft and fuzzy and good and even being in some kind of condescending, compassionate towards those in need elsewhere. It's about our own individual, personal, human salvation as well. It's about a fundamental way to be in life. It's about a way to be that delivers us not only good work and self-satisfaction, it delivers us personal happiness too. And I say that for myself, and so I make a personal appeal for it, you know, from my own experience as well. And so that's all I have, and I encourage everybody, if you're able, take a copy of our newsletter. There's a wonderful article by the Refuseniks in there and their website, which has a lot more of their accounts, and there are other news articles over there. And if anybody wants to receive our newsletter, you can put your address down there on our mailing list thing. And my wife is leaving on the 13th of June to go to Afghanistan, so we go back and forth. So I'll be with the children, she'll be there, and there's a basket there. If anybody wants to make a donation, we always appreciate it. We're a black hole of need for money, and so that's appreciated too. And I'm sorry I had to go so long, and if anybody has to leave, believe me, I won't be offended. But if anybody wants to stay, I'll stay as long as you like. Thanks. I used to have a teacher in Hudson, New Hampshire, who used to always say at the end of each lecture, he said, questions, comments, threats. He was aware of the possibility. But whatever you like to say, please, if anybody has. Yes?
I understand that the Israelis are using CS-18, is it? I was going to ask you about it. Isn't it a type of tear gas that's been outlawed by the Geneva Convention?
The question is the type of tear gas outlawed by the Geneva Convention. I can't answer that. I'm not sure. And I didn't see very much tear gas this time, actually.
I also have heard that the cornerstone has already been laid for the
temple. I can't answer that either. I was there for what they call Jerusalem Day, when there was a large group going there for that purpose, and they were blocked by Israeli police. So that was stopped. The latest thing that I heard is they divided their territories now into 8 regions, administrative regions, making it even harder for the Palestinians to move around. But as you can see from the terrorist attack that happened yesterday, it'll be the front page of the news tomorrow, more Israelis have died since Ariel Sharon became prime minister and took the hard line against Palestinians than died before. So the logic is, you know, of a hardline stance protecting Israelis isn't even true. And 3 times as many Palestinians have died as Israelis, and 10 times as many Palestinians have been injured. So, you know, it's a disaster following these policies for Jews and everyone else. Anyone else? Yes. Good question. Some of the... Yeah.
Name I saw on ZMAC.org named Kristen Schur, who was taken by the Israelis, no charge.
You know, I'm not familiar with the latest to what happened to her, but you know, it's spotty about it. The question is twofold: is Israeli activists, Israelis who have taken internationals and held them without charge, and there were some most recently that it's been done, denied access to the embassy and so on. It's spotty, and it's happened in the past where people have been held. I was arrested 6 years ago at a demonstration against nuclear weapons outside of Dimona, and we were threatened with first with beatings and then with a secret trial at midnight where you have the right to a lawyer, but the trial will be held at midnight, and you'd have only 5 minutes notice, so you technically couldn't get one there. And he said, essentially, they said, you'll disappear, and no one will know where you are. And then we were threatened with deportation, all kinds of things. And then after 12 hours of many threats, where they wanted us to sign various documents promising never to go back to the nuclear weapons site, they released us with nothing. So it's really capricious and weird. Now, your first question, though, was?
What happened to the men?
Yeah, more than 6,000 men were taken from Jenin alone. And other places, many others were taken. Some were released, like the ones, they were 200 in Taiba and 800... 400 in Ramani, who had been released. And so some of these people have gradually been let go. Some cases, they could go back right to their own areas. Some places, there were still closures and other things that prevented it. These people couldn't get to Jenin because there were many. So they're in Tiber and Ramani. They're not with their families, their wives, children, or whatever, because of those restrictions. But they're not still being held. So they're in, like, temporary refugee centers. But many others are still held, just like many people are still held in the United States, down in and at the base in Guantanamo. They're held without charge. It's indefinite. It's very nebulous access to lawyers. And we're setting a standard that, you know, the Israelis have been following for many years, and we're kind of learning from them. They're learning from us. And there are many human rights groups demanding in both countries a full accounting of these people and their treatment. And but Israel is not very responsive to that. Yep.
I'd like to know if you have any clever suggestions for how we can turn Congress around. I mean,
yes.
The Senate, was it 89 senators who wrote this letter urging the Bush administration to let Sharon do whatever he wanted to do?
Yes, he's asking about Congress, and he's correct. There was a resolution by the Senate and the House that was really a defense of Israel resolution that condemned Palestinian violence, talked about Israel under siege, and made no reference whatsoever to any attacks on Palestinians, and was really imbalanced to such a degree that it could be called, without exaggeration, a racist bill. And it passed the House and Senate, and a subsequent bill to send $200 million of additional aid to Israel, more or less the exact opposite. And in both cases, the Bush administration objected to both of these bills. And Colin Powell argued very forcefully that these were counter to peace and that they were too extreme. So Congress is actually right of the Bush administration on Israel. But there were 21 members of Congress that voted against the resolution. And one of them, a Republican from California, made the statement. She said that this kind of legislation makes us the laughingstock of the world. Right. And I think it's very important for each of us to write to our senators and congresspeople and ask them to explain how, in the context of a 3-to-1 casualty rate against Palestinians, we could call Israel under threat. or we could understand, and even in context, the suicide bombing, as horrible as it is, more Israelis die in automobile accidents than from suicide bombings. And that's a horrible thing, but it's not a threat to the state of Israel. It's a threat to tourism. It is. It's a definite threat to tourism, and it's hurt the economy and whatever. But Israelis are still... No Israeli is detained to their house. No Israeli is without running water. No Israeli is being held without charge. No Israeli can't get a lawyer. No Israeli is having tanks surrounding their homes. You know, so it's apples and oranges in the degree of threat. You know, Israeli is being denied by law the ability to walk on a certain road because of their religion or ethnicity. You know, Israel, as currently organized, is every bit a racist state as South Africa was. And it has to be recognized, and it has to be confronted, and it has to be addressed. And Israel can live in peace in that region once it adopts full human rights standards and full democracy that we would expect. Just like South Africa has been able to overcome its conflict by, you know, admitting a majority rule government. And Bishop Tutu, by the way, has made many statements that are very, very, very good. And I have some of them, unfortunately, I don't have copies. You know, appealing for the Israelis to follow the same pattern that they did in South Africa, truth commissions. Well, anti-Semitism is a strange argument because the Palestinians are Semitic people too, but also because so many Israeli Jews and so many American Jews agree 100% that the occupation is wrong. And we need to lean on those people. And remember, those sisters and brothers are really good people, and that their intuitions are every bit as important to the salvation, the reputation of Judaism, as the good Gentiles were who fought against the Nazis. You know, all Christians didn't support the Nazis. You know, there were exceptions. And the integrity of all our traditions are upheld by those Jews, Muslims, and Christians that hold to decent values. And, you know, when somebody makes a statement, you know, Jews are Nazis, I get really angry. I say, look, Jews are all kinds of things. There's lots of diversity in that community. There's lots of diversity in the Israeli community and so on. And don't make those generalizations.
Just a couple of comments. I think one thing that we can do is try to do a better job when we elect our officials. When the President of the United States, in the midst of that mess that was going on in Geneva, calls Ariel Sharon a peace, and Congress passes a resolution saying in support of Israel, where I heard, this is not an exact quote, but close to it, America will always stand for freedom, America will always stand, no, not America, we will always stand for freedom, will always defend democracy, will always defend Israel. The word America was not even there in the resolution. We need to do a much better job electing our officials, because unlike popular belief that our foreign policy does not affect us here, it does, and it does in a big way.
Oh, very much.
On so many toes abroad, 20 years later, someone kills Americans overseas, and we wonder why do they hate?
Why do they? Yeah, exactly.
What did we do wrong?
Exactly.
This is one thing. The other thing is, I can remember that point. It's slipped away. It has something to do with how can we change that? I mean, it is extremely frustrating. I'm a Palestinian American.
Sure.
And some of these pictures, I don't know these people personally. But some of these people that you showed the dead could very well be my cousins. And for me personally, it's extremely difficult to understand or to comprehend the logic behind our foreign policy.
There is no logic.
Well, you know, you've got a couple of things here. And the first thing that I think is... It's the reason why I bring so much material here, and the website information is everybody needs to get as much information as you can, and to get it from organizations that you can quote that are going to be seen as reputable, independent, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Rabbis for Human Rights, so that you can say, look, these Israeli papers, these Israeli groups say such and such. So when you're writing to the congressman and whatever, you're saying, look, you know, that rabbis say such and such. And Israeli soldiers are calling the occupation a humiliation and an outrage. You know, and so then you write with the authority that you're, you know, when they don't immediately come back and say, you're anti-Semites, and look, my thing is full of Semitic sources. And the second thing is, you write to your newspapers too, not just to the congresspeople, because you write to the congresspeople, maybe they ignore the letter or not. You write letters to the editor, they read those too. And I know the union leader for one paper, they print all the letters they get. And you'll get back and forth. And the more it gets out in the public, the more willingness of people to write about this, the more a consensus begins to arise of what's really going on. And you know, and then that change can start to happen. But some things have changed. The demonstration that was held in Washington last month, that's the first time ever I've seen the American peace community stand with the Palestinians. And usually you've tried to bring it up in the past, because I've been dealing with this issue since 88, and I could get no support at all. All my friends working for disarmament, oh, no, no, we can't touch that one. That's a hot potato. Oh, no, no, we just can't. And that's changed. And internationally, there's a consensus. There isn't a country on earth that continues to support Israel. Maybe Britain a little bit tentatively. But really, the United States is the only country that's still having this crazy policy. So we're isolated. And that's also got to be, you know, brought up. And you know, and they've got to be, you know, educated and conflicted. But I, to tell you the truth, my optimism lies with the peace movement. My pessimism lies with the continued, if the occupation isn't stopped, I can honestly project that in 10 years, the Palestinian people will be ethnically eliminated. They're culturally almost already, East Jerusalem is now a majority Jewish population. And the quote-unquote facts on the ground are being established, and it's a Bosnia in slow motion. And unless the settlement movements are stopped, and unless, you know, severe alternatives are made, even if a Palestinian state is finally erected, there will be so much bitterness and anger that it will be a state constantly at war with the Israeli state. So Israel has to not only make peace, it has to make reparations. Not only physical reparations, emotional reparations as well. There has to be an accounting where the people that tortured people, where the people that stole people's land, people that humiliated people, say, we were wrong. As a people, we did wrong. We made Germany go through this. A whole generation had to say, we were wrong. And it has to happen for people to be able to say, now I reach out to you. My wife not only forgave Pat Robinson, she told her what she did was wrong. Hitting her. You know, there's justice as well as peace. Yes?
I need to know. I mean, I am a Jordanian, and my parents are Palestinian, and they are refugees from Palestine. My aunt was shot and killed. So was my uncle. I don't understand the whole Israel. I mean, you're talking about 1967. What about 1948? What about Deir Yassin? So, you're saying that, please, don't hold pictures. I mean, I was in Washington, D.C. in April 22nd. The people were holding these signs. Sharon hugging Hitler hugging Sharon. And you know what? I think Sharon is worse than Hitler. And I'm not saying all Jewish. And we were saying yes to Judaism, no to Zionism. And I think there is a difference. And
sure.
Like Adam Shapiro, I think he's extremely wonderful activist. I mean, I am so proud of him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's like everybody talking about 67. What about 1948? Mm-hmm. Who is the hell is the British to give Israel the right to take 1948 and then move to 1967,
right?
And then destroy, demolish, kill, burn. I mean, just because you haven't heard of the stories, you know, in the 67 or 77 or whatever, just, I mean, how many times that would take a baker and throw him in his bakery? I mean, the things I'm doing, the killings. I mean, it's like those children, they bury families. It's like this occupation. I mean, they make people act. I mean, those people. I mean, whom? All those 18 and 17 and 22 who blog themselves. Do you think they enjoy blowing themselves? I didn't see one Israeli, just one, who's willing to blow themselves up for. I mean, what's the cost? They have no cost. We didn't occupy Israel. They came to us. It finished. Just gave us to them, or gave Palestine before, because every British had Palestine. They occupied Palestine. And then in 19, I mean, who is, so just the UN just gave, I mean, I don't understand.
You, well,
what happened to today we are seeing. Well, I mean, it's like so there are so many refugees in Lebanon, in Palestine, I mean, in Jordan, I mean, all over the world. And those refugees are mistreated.
Right, right. And they're not welcome in the countries where they're in. In Jordan and Lebanon, they're very badly treated. Yes. The point that you're making, though, is a really important one. And we talked to the member of the Knesset about this. We asked this very progressive guy that favored a two-state solution. I said, do you consider yourself a Zionist? And he said, yes. And I said, what do you mean by that? He said, I believe that the Jewish people had a right to a state. And I said, well, what about the indigenous people who were not Jewish? What about their rights? And he said, well, our treatment of the Arab people was no different than your treatment of blacks in the United States. And I said, well, the treatment of the blacks in the United States in some ways may have been worse. They were slaves. I said, but it's no longer done by statute. And he said, what about your treatment of the Indians? And I said, that's a better comparison. I said, they were exterminated. In fact, my mother's family came over in the Mayflower. She helped do it. Her family helped do it here in New England. You don't see Indians all over the place in New England anymore. And I said, but the difference is, maybe we realize in the United States, centuries later, that we can't or won't give back Manhattan to the Indians. But no self-respecting progressive American today sits here and says, gee, I think that was a good thing that was done. I support manifest destiny. I think it was great that white people got this country. Nobody would say that. And he is a progressive Jew that can sit here and say, I support Zionism. I think it was right that Jews stole this land. Is a very, very profound problem. And that's a problem of ethnic nationalism all over the world, whether it's the BJP in India, the Hindu Nationalist Party, or the Croatian fascists, or the One Nation Party in Australia. The notion that people will take a land and make it an ethnic monoculture, ethnic and religious monoculture, is a very, very dangerous thing. And there's no question in my mind that from the beginning, the Zionist enterprise to create the Israeli state was a racist enterprise. And I think that the state of Israel is perpetually going to have problems in that region so long as that racism is maintained. Because even if there's a Palestinian state, one-fifth of Israeli citizens are Arabs. And not only the ones that are refugees, the ones that are inside Israel, and they get 60 cents on a dollar of tax money, they can't work certain jobs, they can't live certain places, they will be a civil rights movement for Israeli Arabs, like for blacks in America. And if they get full rights, and if people get the right to their property, the Jewish majority state will disappear. But I think that, you know, all of these issues have got to be dealt with in terms, not in terms of historical injustice, but in terms of political realism. There are generations of Israelis now who did not steal the land in 47. There are children and grandchildren who were born in Tel Aviv and Haifa. There are Protestants in Northern Ireland, I'm Irish, who are the great-great-grandchildren of Presbyterians who stole the land from Catholics in Northern Ireland. You know, would it be just in some historical sense to throw them all out back to England? Yes. Would it be just in some historical sense to say to all the Jews, give all the land back to everybody that has deeds? Yes. Is it just in some real sense to these children that grew up in this place? Probably not. And which country on earth doesn't have land in the historical boundaries that weren't stolen from other places? The whole third of the United States was stolen from Mexico. You know, should we give it back to Mexico? Should we give back New France? Should we give back, you know, these are hard, hard, hard questions. I think if people are going to live in peace today, we've got to deal with some level of political realism where land is exchanged, people are given dignity, and apologies are made all around, and where some compensation to refugees is given. But that region is not going to sustain, you know, whether it's a million more Palestinians or a million more Jews, it's not going to be possible. So, you know, I don't know how that can be resolved by people getting their land back in Haifa and Tel Aviv. I think that's a justice issue that probably can't be met. You know, and...
We should not, like, forget the war crime.
No. That history has to be remembered, yes.
And those who are recent, that were within the past 50 years, and I just want the American people also to know that from Ariel Sharon to the old leaders before him, they bring Israel people from all over the world. I mean, from all over the world to Israel. They give them an Israel passport and the right to live. But yet, I mean, they expel Palestinians and they don't allow any refugees to come and go back to their homes.
there's no question about it. It's a horrible, unbelievable, unrelenting injustice. We have to be careful about history, because just like you can remember all of these things, and Dar es Salaam is an unbelievable story. For example, there are Israelis who will just, they focus exclusively on the terrorist bombings, on the killing of innocents there. And on the same day that I was in Jerusalem watching Arab TV showing Jenin, all the channels, channel to channel, three Israeli channels were showing a retrospective of the Holocaust. So they're focusing on suffering in their minds, and in each case, people are angry and they feel like victims, even if they're the oppressor. And this is some of the cloud of humanity, where we focus on our hurts, so when we feel so hurt, we don't feel bad when we hurt somebody else's children. You know, and we have to try to broaden it. We have to try to broaden our awareness, and all of that suffering and all that stuff has got to be acknowledged, and got, you know, on all sides, and has got to be addressed, and has got to be brought in the public, and justice has got to be provided. And it can be provided. Jews and Muslims and Christians lived in that region before without killing each other, and it can happen again. But, you know, our country is the key, especially with the military aid. Our country is the key. I think I'm being bumped.
We don't even have time for one more question. Let's give Scott our thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
You know.